So we're on 435, which is on page 234. Yaj gyatva na punar moham evam yasyasi pandava yena bhutan yasheshani drakshyas yatman yato mayi. Yaj gyatva na punar moham evam yasyasi pandava yena bhutan yasheshani drakshyas yatman yato mayi. Yajgyatva na punar moham evam yasyasi pandava yena bhutan yasheshani drakshyas yatman yato mayi. Yajgyatva na punar moham evam yasyasi pandava yena bhutan yasheshani drakshyas yatman yato mayi. Yajgyatva na punar moham evam yasyasi pandava yena bhutan yasheshani drakshyas yatman yato mayi. Yajgyatva na punar moham evam yasyasi pandava yena bhutan yasheshani drakshyas yatman yato mayi. Yet. Was somebody about to go when I cut him off? Oh, please, go ahead, Rakshit Prabhu. Yajgyatva na punar moham evam yasyasi pandava yena bhutan yasheshani drakshasyatman yato mayi. Yet. Which. Gyatva. Knowing. Na. Never. Punaha. Again. Moham. To illusion. Evam. Like this. Yasyasi. You shall go. Pandava. O son of Pandu. Yena. By which. Bhutani. Living entities. Sheshani. All. Drakshasi. You will see. So I have a question. What does drakshasi mean? Very good. Atmani. In the Supreme Soul. Atau. Or in other words. Mayi. In me. What does gyatva mean?
Knowing.
Yeah. So yaj gyatva na means.
Never.
Punaha.
Again.
Moham. So what about yajgyatva na punar moham?
My knowing which one does not get illusion.
If you need the middle room, were you given the middle room before? Somebody, can we unlock that middle room? Just in case you need to go in and out of the middle room if she gets a little too restless, you can feel free to go in there. We used to have toys and stuff in there. I think it's either this one.
I'll check it out.
Okay. Thanks, no hurry. Only when you need, just so it'll be open, just in case. Don't mind. Okay, so you said, Prabhuji, you said it means yajgyatva na punar moham.
By knowing which one does not get illusion.
Yeah. And then, evam, like this, yastasi, you shall go, pandava yena. Okay, and then it tells about what is the nature when someone doesn't fall back into illusion. What is the nature of their realization when they're enlightened? Because the previous verse talked about how to become enlightened, tadvidi pranipatena. The previous verse talked about approaching somebody with great humility who has knowledge and rendering service and inquiring submissively, and from that you can obtain knowledge. And that's, let's talk about that just for a minute before we go into the next verse. And that is that, that this idea that where we get our knowledge and our guidance in this world. I mean, does it come in an isolated way? Or what is the normal method?
We get knowledge from those who know, by inquiring from those who know, talking from those who know. The principle there is that real knowledge is coming via a descending process from those who know, rather than through the ascending process where one says, I myself will find out by speculation and doing it, and embarking on a path of inquiry with one's own mind and ego without consultation with someone who knows. So real knowledge, the Bhagavad Gita says, comes via this descending process by asking those who know, who have seen the truth.
Okay, well, that's the principle. Thank you very much. Now, let's have some examples. Yes, Bhuji.
I wanted to
give him the microphone.
Add something.
Yes, please add.
According to the scriptures, it is said that there are three ways to acquire knowledge.
Yes.
One is pratyaksha praman, that is by sensual perception. Then it is anuman praman, by approximation. And the third one is the shabda praman, that is by the scriptures, the Vedic scriptures.
And there's one more, actually, even. We just read last night. When Lord Krishna speaks to Uddhava, he said there's four ways you can get knowledge. Shruti pratyaksham aityam anumanam chatushtayam pramaneshpanavastana vikalpat savirajate. Are they on the phone or something? Could you tell them to keep it quiet? Four kinds of ways, Krishna says, that you should find out about this world. One is shruti, which means hearing from, specifically from the Shastra, from that literature which is not created in this material world, which was from beyond this material world, which descends downward. It's spiritual sound vibration. Shruti pratyaksham means, pratyaksha means direct perception. You can look around and, you know, you can see things for yourself. And anuman, which means hypothesis or deduction. And then aityam also is there, which means traditional wisdom. So he adds that one. So he says that through those types of ways of getting knowledge, you should see that the material world is not stable, that we don't have a steady position here, that we can leave at any minute. Kamala jala dala jivana talamala. In Bengali, that Krishnadas says, life is like hanging in the balance, like we're a little drop of water on a lotus leaf, and at any minute it can just drop off. So it's not stable. And therefore, one should be detached from things in the material world. So, you want to continue with your point? Okay, so what I'm getting at is this. Okay, Dainidi, go ahead.
Well, I just wanted to
elaborate on what Raksha said.
Yes.
More than just conversing with someone who knows the truth, because as it says in this verse, it's inquiring submissively,
yes,
and rendering service. Because simply just by speaking to someone who knows the truth, you may get the truth, but specifically by submissively inquiring and then rendering service, I think you're more apt to actually get...
This is the essence. So let's talk about this. This idea, there's an idea here that's very interesting. This is about submissively inquiring and rendering service to someone, how there's some kind of intangible way that that you're actually becoming elevated in knowledge. and you're able to conduct yourself in a higher mode by this kind of association. Now, what I'm asking is how this takes place, like some examples of how this takes place, not just in the setting of, say, spiritual life, where one approaches a priest or a guru or some senior kind of person who's very experienced, but what about in the regular course of our lives? Does this happen? Do we gain knowledge independently, or is there some example of how we get knowledge from actually approaching an authority? In that more subtle way that Dainiti Prabhu is bringing up, rendering service, humbly listening. You were going to say something, Shyam. One more up.
Like television, newspaper, and talking to people, learning from the elders. These are the general sources of knowledge for most.
Okay. Satya?
Well, we also know that in any learning situation, especially like if we go to school, could be from elementary school to somebody doing their PhD, where you come under the guidance of a professor. If the student is eager to learn, and the professor detects that eagerness and that sincerity, it draws out of the professor knowledge, and the professor, the teacher, becomes inspired to teach from within his heart. And if that eagerness isn't there, then the inspiration's not there, and there's no exchange. The student can't receive, and the student can't draw out the knowledge out of the teacher, and the teacher's also not inspired to teach.
That's, this is going towards it, that there's a transference of knowledge and inspiration and position. When you meet somebody, a living entity, who's, got something, just by association, you can actually get that. And especially if it's some kind of intimate association, the most kind of intimate association is when you go offer yourself, render some service. You say, I respect what you have, and I want to follow you. And, you offer yourself in submission. That's the idea of this previous verse. Tad vidhi pranipatina. Pranipat, it's a specific word. Pranipat, which means that you go submit yourself. You don't go in a challenging mood, but when you submit yourself, what is your state of consciousness when you see, a person who has knowledge and can help you? What is this state of pranipat? Let's talk about that. So would everyone agree that when you approach somebody submissively, humbly, that it opens you up? Does anybody not agree?
There's also an aspect of surrender that the person has come to the stage that the individual from whom they have decided to inquire has the knowledge and is very elevated and can impart it to them. But that the process is that you come to the master in a submissive, surrendering way. Then the transference occurs. That mood has to be created. It's the disciple, it's the Shishya-Guru relationship, the disciple-master relationship. And in the disciple-master relationship, the disciple is very humble and humbly inquiring. So there is some aspect of surrender that is involved.
And does that... Like in that example you gave, it's almost on a grand scale that there's a great master and then someone approaches. But does it take place in everyday kind of situations?
Yeah, it does, sure.
Hans Priya's shaking her head. Can you think of everyday kind of situations where that takes place?
Yeah, my boss, a new boss started. Uh-huh. He was asking what their management style is like, what's their working style. And he said, mean. So I said, great.
So So in everyday situations, if you see someone who has something, you know, what's the most efficient way to learn from that person? If you approach submissively and humbly in an open way, you know, please teach me, then you can learn something. And there's a special influence that Satyadeva Prabhu was bringing out, that when you approach somebody in a humble mood, and that inspires the teacher also. The teacher, and render service, that's the other thing. Tadvidi pranipatine pariprashnena means you ask questions. Pariprashnena sevaya, you render service. This is interesting. What about service? What is it about service? That why is that in that verse? When you approach somebody for knowledge, why do you do service? I remember as kids, there used to be the cliche, if you know, you bring an apple and put it on the teacher's desk. You know, that's a little seva. That's a little service. Seva means service. So you do a little service to the person. What is it about that makes the exchange of knowledge possible? That's what Krishna is saying in this verse 34. Let's talk about that.
Clean the blackboard.
You know, or do something for the... Yes, Dainiti.
Well, we're asking what the result of that service is. Satyadeva was saying, you know, that the that the speaker feels inspired, the teacher feels inspired. So I'm thinking that... I'm thinking of the word gratitude, that I don't know if this is right, but that the teacher is grateful that the student is offering some service. So because they feel grateful for the service, they feel inspired to... you know, give some knowledge, I guess.
You know it's true because you've experienced it, right? Haven't you? Everyone's experienced this. If someone approaches you in a submissive way and renders some service to you, don't you feel gratitude towards them? Don't you feel obligated? There's a saying in Japanese that there's nothing so expensive as that which is free. I mean, if somebody gives you something just out of, you know, appreciation, you know, you every time you see them, at least this is how I feel. Someone does something for me, and then every time I see them, I'm thinking, how can I repay them? You know, from a heart level, you feel like you want to do something back. You want to give something back. And if some, yes, Jonathan. No, go ahead. Please, please. Where's the other one?
It's on. Just turn it all the way up.
It might not be working. Needs a battery, maybe. Okay, you're on, Jonathan. Ramaswamy, our technical department, and every other department will help fix it. Okay.
I think it also opens the recipient up more, too. I remember when I was a child, my father would always tell me that you appreciate something more if you're giving something in return for that.
Oh, like that's a good point.
Children that, you know, just get a car on their 16th birthday. Mm. A lot of the times they'll go out and they'll crash it, they'll junk it up because they don't know how to appreciate it. But when you're giving service for something that you're receiving, like knowledge, if you're giving your own service, you're able to appreciate it more. You give it value. And so when you're giving service to teachers, when you... become submissive, then you're able to take it in more. You don't take it for granted as much.
Oh, this is an excellent point that Jonathan's making. That, you know, when you actually render some service for something, for say for knowledge, then you know it's like you're paying for it almost, and you imbibe it. You feel like you deserve it, and you do. When you give something in return, if free means what? Doesn't have that much value. There's a story about the boy going door to door with these beautiful mangoes from his grove, and he wanted to give them away free, and then no one would take them. So an elderly person was walking by and says, tell them they're $5 each. So then he went $5 each, and he said, well, how many can I get? You know, the value is there. And in the Bhagavatam also, Krishna talks about this. He says, let's see, there's a verse in the 11th canto. If you look in your shloka books, this is the shloka book. It says, Srila Prabhupada shlokas on the outside, this color, on page 268 of this book. Down at the bottom of 268, there's this verse, Tasmad Gurum Prapadyeta Jignasu Shreya Uttamam Shabde Paricha Nishnatam Brahman Upashrama Shrayam. And let's see. That is not the verse I was looking for. I'm sorry. It's related. But what I wanted to refer to was not that verse either. Kshatriya Brahma Nishtam. Okay. Can you find that?
Yeah.
It's gone out of my head right now. I can't remember how it starts. Kshatriya Brahma Nishtam is the second line. Samit Pani. Tad Vignanartam Sagaru Gurum Eva Bigachet Samit Pani Bra. Okay. 360. Thank you, Narhari Prabhu. 360 is the page. Okay, here it is. Mundaka Upanishad. Thanks to Satyadev Prabhu. Tad Vignanartam Sagurum Eva Bigachet Samit Pani. Kshatriyam Brahmanishtam. Now this goes right to the point of what we're talking about, okay? Tad vijnana artam, to learn that transcendental subject matter. Sa, one, gurum, a spiritual master, eva, certainly, abhigachet, one must approach. Samitpani, now this is a very interesting concept here. Samitpani means carrying firewood in his hand. And what it means, really, is to do some kind of service. It means some menial service. And this samitpani traditionally meant that the guru was performing this fire yajna every day. You know, and to make the fire every day, you know, you need ingredients. And one of the main ingredients is wood to do the fire yajna. So the disciple would go out and collect wood. It's sort of a menial service, go out in the forest. So how is collecting wood related to getting knowledge? But that's what this verse is saying, that this is part and parcel of getting the knowledge, that you're going out and doing something, some service to the person who's imparting the knowledge to you. It's a very powerful concept. If you think about it, you render this service, samipani, carrying the firewood. Who that you can think of from the Srimad Bhagavatam carried firewood for his spiritual master?
Krishna himself.
Can you tell us more about that? He went out with his friend, and he was in Gurukul. Krishna was in the Gurukul, right? And he went out and he collected wood with his friend, Sudama Brahman, Sudama Vipra. And they got caught in a hurricane. They were out all night, and the spiritual master, Sandipani Muni, was worried about them. Because they're his disciples, they went out to bring him wood, and they almost sacrificed their lives. They were out in the forest all night. So he went looking for them next day and found them huddled, you know, under a tree, and he blessed them, you know, because of your sacrifice. He felt like he owed them, you know, he wanted to give them more. So this in this samitpani, and then kshatriyam means expert in understanding the Vedic conclusion, brahmanishtam, constantly engaged in the service of the Supreme Personality of God. And the translation is, to learn the transcendental subject matter, one must approach a spiritual master. In doing so, he should carry fuel to burn in sacrifice. The symptom of such a spiritual master is that he's expert in understanding the Vedic conclusion, and therefore he constantly engages in the service of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So what are some of the key words in this verse? In your opinion. Can you say more about that? Can you give her the hot mic? What about sacrifice? And tell us the word in there that you're referring to.
I don't know.
Summit funny.
Well, just say about sacrifice. Why'd you say that?
Well, you know, sacrifice is very hardest thing to do in this day-to-day life, waking up early in the morning, sacrifice your sleep. So we can just start out our day sacrificing things for Krishna, or for our own satisfaction, so we can feel good about waking up early and starting out our day better. I think it's everything is sacrifice, even when it's your work. You don't get the, you've been working all your last couple of years, working hard to get to achieve a certain position, and you have sacrificed, you know, so many of your own things to achieve that goal, your family life, your, you know, personal desires. And unfortunately, the material sacrifice, it doesn't get you anywhere. I think the spiritual sacrifice, also we struggle to do that, but I was listening to lecture from Prabhupada, and he said certain things we have to do, and it's wonderful to do volunteer sacrifice.
Volunteer sacrifice. Nice point. Thank you very much about sacrifice. And, of course, at certain point in our life, it's not that we can just divorce ourselves from what you were saying is material sacrifice. In other words, we have obligations to, you know, take care of our body, to take care of our family. You may have some financial obligation that you have to take care of. But Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita that all of those sacrifices, they don't have to be material. Otherwise, how are we ever going to make any advancement? If we're caught in that and, you know, something obligatory, we have to do it. You can't just reject it and walk away. Who can do that? You can't just leave your responsibilities. Like even in the Bhagavad Gita, Arjuna was thinking of maybe just leaving his responsibility. But by your own work, in the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says, by your own work, sway, whatever your work is, if you connect it with Krishna, that sacrifice becomes spiritual. So anyone can do it. If Arjuna could be a soldier and use that type of work to connect to Krishna, then anybody can do it. An executive secretary can do it, right? Anyone can connect to Krishna. And this is Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita, that whatever sacrifice you make, you can connect it to me. Who knows the verse? Yes, that's it. Yet Koroshi Yarashnasi Yet Johosi Dadasi. So give us a little taste of what that means.
Yet Koroshi is whatever you do. Yadashnasi Ashna means whatever you eat. Yet Johosi.
Whatever activities
you do, whatever you eat, whatever activities perform, do that as an offering unto me.
And yet tapasasi.
Yet tapasasi. So whatever.
Any tapasya you do.
So whatever austerities and whatever sacrifices you do that as an offering unto me. So
okay.
Specifically.
So he's saying whatever you do, really it means anything that you do. So how do you connect it to Krishna? How does your work become a sacrifice then to Krishna? What's the idea?
Well, Krishna says in the beginning that one must, in the initial stages, one must work and offer his results. And when makes further advancement, he says, you work just for the sake of work. You're not attached because you do it as a duty. It's an obligation. So, you know, and like he says that if you remain without work, then no one can sustain themselves without working, not even for a moment. Like even if you remain idle, the senses may be idle, but the mind is still active. So still, you will have to perform some way. You will have to act in some way or the other. So it says, it's better that you act for my pleasure rather than, acting.
Okay, but we're talking about if you have work to do, like, you know, you have a job to perform for Microsoft. That's not doing anything for Krishna's pleasure, right? So how do you connect your job at Microsoft to Krishna consciousness?
Well, when you...
You said it already.
When you work for any company, whatever, you know, Microsoft or Google or whatever it may be, but at the end of the day, or whatever is your pay cycle, you are given some fruits of the work. And these fruits can be engaged in the service of, you know, Krishna. So if you have some certain salary, you know, you have to live in a house, so make your house a temple. So make Krishna as the center of your life. So and then you have to eat. So offer everything that you have to eat to Krishna, and then eat. So Krishna becomes the center of your life. You have to drink, you have to eat. So, and then you have to sleep. So if you have to sleep, make sure, you know, we can make our sleep as a service so that we can sleep. So next day we are ready and refreshed so we can serve Krishna.
Or Microsoft.
Serve Krishna.
So serving Krishna, getting the essence of what you're saying, thank you very much, is, you know, whatever work you're doing, you have to find a way to connect it to Krishna. Yet koroshi, whatever you do, yet ashnashi, whatever you eat, whatever you offer and give away, whatever austerities you perform, do it as a sacrifice to me. So there's no stage at which you can't make that connection to Krishna. And we also can't artificially give up what our work is. Is one of the messages of the Bhagavad Gita. You can't just, you know, walk away from what your particular work is, because you'll just go do it somewhere else. Like Arjuna was a warrior, and he was thinking of going off to the forest and becoming a beggar or something, and Krishna said, you know, you may try that, but because of the mode of nature you're in, you're going to end up doing the work of a kshatriya anyway, so you might as well do your work here on the battlefield, but do it for me. So has anybody had this experience that you work somewhere and then you sacrifice some of the fruit of your work and what that feels like to give away what you earned? I mean, to the materially conditioned mind, you know, I'm working hard. Why? So I can get the fruit. So then at the end, yes. Well, we have a $100 bill waiting for you. When you do ask a stupid question, we'll hand it over to you.
You just had said something like, you just said that you work, and the fruits of your work, you give away, something like that. If I work, and I earn more than I need, and I give that,
well, let me ask you, when you work and you take some of that money and you give it, instead of keeping it, you know, just piling it up in a CD somewhere or something like that, but instead you send it off to feed the poor in Africa, how do you feel?
I feel good.
Why do you think you feel good?
Maybe because my spirit is close to God.
Yeah, that's true. So this is the idea. If you sacrifice well, not directly, but Krishna recommends this. Krishna recommends in the Bhagavad Gita that you should learn to give, be in this spirit of giving, because
that's giving to other, the poor.
That's okay. That's okay. The idea is, first of all, we come into this world with nothing. We leave it with nothing. While we're here, there's a lesson to learn, and that is that we're not the controllers or the enjoyers, but I think I'm the controller or enjoyer. And I try to manipulate my environment so that I can enjoy more and control more. But eventually, I'm not the controller and enjoyer. So when I learn to give away the fruit of my work, one way or the other, I learn a lesson. And that is, by giving, I become happy. Now the next question is, where's the best place to give where someone can actually, you know, utilize it the best? Now here's an example. Say I'm driving in a car. And I know that I have a good friend. And this friend has a son. And the son somehow or other got amnesia and then went away from home and has been lost for the last 5 years. Nobody knows where he is. And of course, the parents, you know, they can't sleep for the last 5 years because they don't know where their son is. And people have been looking for him everywhere. They can't find him. So, you know, I happen to go to Kansas City and I'm driving down the road and I see that son of my friend. He's there at the intersection and he's begging with a little tin cup. And he looks hungry and his, you know, clothes are all ragged and everything. So two things maybe I could do. One is I drive up, roll down my window and say, here's $20, and then I drive off. That's A. B, I could drive up and, you know, say, I know who you are. I know where you live. You know, get in the car, and I'll take you home. And you call the parents, and you make the connection. So there's giving. I mean, I could just give them $20 and drive away. Or I could give them knowledge about, you know, who he is and actually reconnect him back to, you know, his original home and such. So looking at different scenarios of how to actually give, we can see that there may be, I mean, giving, it's all good, but ways of giving that we actually water the root, or we actually solve the complete problem, or we do the highest good for somebody by giving. And so, you know, by giving someone Krishna consciousness, by giving someone knowledge and, you know, connecting them, reconnecting them to, you know, what their real purpose is in life, this is considered to be the most valuable kind of charity. More valuable than if I just build them a house, which is good. I mean, it's valuable. And there are people that do that. Bill and Melinda Gates have a huge organization now where they're helping people all over the world. They're really good at it. And so we're happy they're doing it. But we're not as good at doing that kind of stuff. But what we are good at doing is distributing knowledge so that people can understand who they are. I mean, we applaud everyone who's, you know, and there are lots of people who do that kind of work, you know, helping the poor, helping people with AIDS, helping with cataracts and things like that. And that is definitely relieves a little bit of the suffering temporarily. But what our mission is focused on specifically is giving knowledge about Krishna so that one can, you know, get in the car, come back home, and figure out who they are exactly. So it kind of relates with your question in the sense of, like, giving. Where do you give? Where do you give your energy? And Krishna talks about this in the Bhagavad Gita, that any way that you get in the giving spirit and helping others, you'll start to reflect and realize that actually I feel better giving it away than I do keeping it for myself. It's better to give than receive. That's the old cliche. And actually it's true because it's our nature. We're in our spiritual essence, we're essentially giving agents. And the more we're engaged in giving and giving, the happier we feel. It's just a fact. But the Srimad Bhagavatam talks about how the best way to give is by giving to the person who can accept unlimitedly. You know, Krishna can take everything that we give him. And also, when we, just like watering the root of a tree, when you water the root of the tree, all the branches and leaves become also satisfied. So God is the root of all the creation. And when he becomes satisfied, then everyone else becomes satisfied also. Within the case of serving Krishna, it also includes serving all living beings. Like someone who's a servant of God, they would not, for instance, think it was logical to, you know, go kill another living being in order to feed somebody. Just as an example, there may be problems with the way I try to give to other people if I'm not in God consciousness. So idea is like, okay, well, I'll go feed the poor. Well, what are you going to feed them? Oh, give them chicken. Well, wait a minute. There may be some karma involved in that. You may not be helping them as much as you think. You feed them something, but then actually there's a reaction because there's an animal that was killed according to the Vedas. you know, the person who killed the animal and then transports it. You know, Buddha talked about this too, that don't kill these animals because you're going to get a reaction for it. So there's implications. And however, if I'm giving to Krishna, then, you know, I'm not thinking I'll kill this living entity to help that other living entity. It's a perfect kind of giving, because in that sense, you'd offer to Krishna and then you'd distribute to everybody the spiritual food. Jonathan.
So when you are giving service to a spiritual master, should you also think about how you're giving? Like, is the best way to serve a spiritual master by serving Krishna, by giving your service to that spiritual master through...
Well,
I mean, other than, you know, just like material service for that spiritual master, or is that also...
No, well, that will also be there. I mean, the idea of the spiritual master is someone who's a representative of Krishna. And, you know, someone might say, well, forget the representative, I just want to see Krishna directly. You know, why do I have to... Let's cut out the middleman, you know. And sort of like there's an example of a telescope. There's a big end and a small end. And someone might see this big telescope and say, well, forget the little end, let me look through the big end. I want to see more. And so they look through the big end, and what do they see? They don't see anything. But if you look through the small end that's specially meant for your eye, you know, that little part there, and you look out, and then it expands out, and you can see everything. So a guru, a spiritual master, there are qualifications mentioned, but the idea is that for your particular circumstance and at time and place, Krishna sends you somebody who's custom made just for you, so that you can look through the small end and see the big picture. That's the idea. And as far as service goes, you know, there's a protocol for service. Of course, you know, if someone asks you for water, and then you come back and bring milk or orange juice, that's not very good service. You didn't hear what they said. You do what they say. And then Prabhupada used to say, there's three kinds of servants, you know, first class, second class, third class. And the first class servant gets to understand what the person's needs and desires are, anticipates, and does it before he or she asks. That's the first class service. You figure it out because you're so intently into serving, you're always looking to find out where is it where I could render service so that person would be satisfied, and you're observing everything, and you're using your spiritual intelligence to see what does he or she need, and then I'll provide it before they ask, even. And then second class is that the teacher asks, and then you do it. And third one is he or she asks, and then you don't do it, or you don't do it right, something like that. So, you know, there's different refinements of service also. So when you approach somebody to offer service, you know, if you're really in tune and you're humble and you're looking to render the right kind of service, then you'll render direct service to that person. And also, as Srila Prabhupada speaks in the Chaitanya Charitamrita, that the spiritual master doesn't care if somebody brings him money, but when somebody comes who's making spiritual advancement and actually becoming elevated in spiritual life, then that spiritual master becomes very satisfied, seeing that the disciple's engaged. We have these prayers that we sing during the Brahma Muhurta hour, around 4:30 in the morning, and they're all about the qualities of a spiritual master. It's called the Guruvashtakam prayers. Shang Sharadava Nada Lita Loka Tranaya Karunya Gana Ganatvam. It describes how a guru, a spiritual teacher, first of all, guru means what?
Heavy.
Means heavy. Heavy with knowledge. You know, the person's, you know, got both feet on the ground, just heavily, you know, invested in spiritual life. And, you know, is not going to be just fly away with any changes in the material world, whatever way the wind blows. No, that person is fixed, steady, spiritual life, because they're heavy with knowledge. And in this verse, the spiritual master is described as a cloud, having the quality of a cloud. And so when there's a forest fire and everything's burning around you, what can you do but pray for rain? And when the rain comes, it's just such a relief, you know, because all your problems are solved. All of a sudden, the rain comes and the fire just gets quelled. So that's one quality of the spiritual master. Another is mentioned, Chaturvidha Sri Bhagavat Prasada, Swadana Triptan Hari Bhakta Sangan, Kritvaiva Triptim Bhajata Sadaiva, Vande Guru Sri Charanadavindam. Worshipping the spiritual master. The spiritual master becomes happy when he sees the disciples eating Bhagavat Prasad. It actually pleases the spiritual master. That's a spiritual activity, taking, you know, spiritual food. So a spiritual teacher will become very satisfied if he sees the disciple engaged in that activity. So yeah, a spiritual teacher will become very satisfied when he sees the disciple engaged in serious devotional service to Krishna. That's the best way to serve the spiritual master, is to take up spiritual life very seriously. Did that answer your question? Yes, Prashant Prabhu.
It gave a wide variety of answers. First one being what is love? I mean, is it just a hormonal exchange, or is it just release of certain hormones, or is it something called love, or is anything just a pure hormonal release, or something sentimental or something emotional? Another thing is it's about how do you know if a person has truly tasted love of God? Can you just look at it? And you might be in any conditioned state. I'm not sure what kind of. But how do you come to know? I mean, does his activities change? I'm using a couple of examples in this regard. One is Pundalika Vidhi, I don't know. He went mad, right, when he tasted it. I mean, he literally went mad. And it's also the case with Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. He also lost his state. So a person who might have tasted it, he would not be normal, right? I mean, I have just two questions. First.
Is that a question?
Yeah.
Okay, so there's a famous verse in the Srimad Bhagavatam that Chaitanya Mahaprabhu received from his spiritual master, that talks about how when one chants the holy name of God, that after some time he becomes very attached to chanting. And specifically, there's certain names of God that he becomes very, very attracted to. And then as he continues in that process of chanting, that his heart melts. His heart becomes very soft. In the material sense, we become hard-hearted. This is the disease, material life. We become hard-hearted. But in spiritual life, it actually means that the heart melts. It's called jhuta chitta. It's actually melting, becoming soft. And you, like the verse we heard earlier from the Ishapanishad, that a spiritually minded person never hates anything or any being. On the contrary, as Krishna says in the sixth chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, that atmau pam yena sarvatra. He says that a spiritually minded person, an advanced spiritual person, actually feels empathy to all kinds of living entities. So his heart's melting. And then sometimes, as you pointed out, the person will actually, in sort of some spiritual madness, become even make public displays of chanting and dancing without considering what others think, even, because the person's so swept away by spiritual emotion. So, there, that famous verse comes from the 11th canto of the Srimad Bhagavatam. And in that commentary on that verse, there's a description of how there are many spiritually advanced people who don't show such external emotions. They may not have tears coming from their eyes, or they may not dance in ecstasy and show those kinds of things on a regular basis. So you can't necessarily judge by that. you know, what is the besides, somebody might fake it also. There's people who make a living out of that, who, you know, they'll cry and they'll make all kinds of a show to attract, you know, an innocent public or something. So maybe difficult to tell. However, Madhvacharya commented on this verse many, many years ago, and he said that some great advanced souls, they show external symptoms and some don't show external symptoms, but there's two symptoms that are always there in advanced souls. And the two things are, number one, he said, is steadiness. You'll find that they're always steady in spiritual life. In other words, you can see day in, day out, they're practicing. When, you know, when times get tough, they're practicing. When times are good, they're practicing. It's not like times get good and they go, yahoo, forget this for a while, you know. Or, you know, times are rough and they say, oh, there's no God anyway, you know, because why would he do this to me? No, they're always steady. They're always, you know, performing devotional service in any circumstance. And the second thing is that whatever they say, what vibration comes from their mouths is beneficial. It's merciful. In other words, they speak for the benefit of others. They live for the benefit of helping other living beings, showing kindness. They show kindness to living beings. So what they say is actually sweet. It's a great benefit to others. So those are the two symptoms that you can always tell, Madhvacharya said, if you observe carefully a spiritually advanced person. Are they steady? And how do they speak? And then, of course, you know, we talked about this a couple of weeks ago in the development of love of God. There are street signs. You know, just, you know, you're on the right path. You can follow the signs. And it's a science. There's a science of love of God. First, there's this whole science in the nectar of instruction that is the essence of advice by Rupa Goswami, who tells, you know, things to follow and things to avoid, and you'll make rapid advancement if you do these six things, and you'll fall down if you do these six things. And so he tells about those things. And then later on in the Shastra, it tells about how you should feel, what your symptoms are as you become more advanced in devotional service. Raksha Prabhu.
Well, it just occurred to me.
Microphone.
Sorry. In addition to the two symptoms that you mentioned about the spiritual master, that he has steadiness, one, and two, he conveys very beneficial knowledge. This verse that we just looked at in the Shloka book, which is on page 360, the one about. From the Mundaka Upanishad, talks about other symptoms of the spiritual master. This was the verse which said, to learn the transcendental subject matter, one must approach a spiritual master. In doing so, he should carry fuel to burn in sacrifice, which we talked about. But the later part of that translation says that the symptom of such a spiritual master is that he is expert in understanding the Vedic conclusion, and therefore he constantly engages in the service of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So these are also the characteristics of the spiritual master, that he is an authority in spiritual knowledge, and he is the representative of the Supreme Personality of Godhead.
That's right. So these, as far as the qualifications go, these are, you know, given here, especially Chaitanya Mahaprabhu said, anyone who knows the science of Krishna consciousness, it doesn't matter what background that person's from. You can approach and get great benefit. Take that person as a spiritual master. Even Chaitanya Mahaprabhu himself did that. He accepted Ramananda Roy. At the time that social climate in India, Ramananda Roy was not somebody that a sannyasi would talk to. He was the governor of the state. He was considered to be from a low-class family and such. But because he was full of knowledge, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu accepted him as one of his gurus. And he approached him like that. Kipa bipra kipa nyasi shudra kena noi ye krishna tattva veta se guru hoy. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu said, if someone knows the science, then that person is a guru. So, back to the Bhagavad Gita. Narhari Prabhu?
Prabhu, I have one question.
Okay, microphone.
You mentioned that
Yeah, no, fine, go ahead.
You mentioned that you know, this principle even acts in regular everyday life. Where,
yes.
If someone is rendering service, you know, we become obligated. In spiritual life, like when we are rendering service, the person, for example, maybe if I'm rendering service to my Guru Maharaj, he may not be personally present, but he knows, or you know, like with anyone, like you know, you are rendering service to Srila Prabhupada. Srila Prabhupada knows that even when he was personally present on the planet, he may not have been. But it's not the same case in everyday life. Like suppose if I'm doing something for my say my physics teacher or something, and he doesn't know I'm doing it, then how does that?
Well, it'll come out eventually, because if you have a teacher disciple relationship in any sphere, the teacher knows. That's the duty of the teacher to know the psyche of the person. So, as an example, you know, just like when you come to class, teacher looks out and can see who's prepared and who's not. They know that because they have so much experience. They can look out in the class and say, that person's really steady and they're really, you know, they've been serving, you know. They're really trying to do this. And they can see that. It'll come out eventually in that relationship between disciple and student. It's not exactly the same thing, you know, as we talk about how there's sort of a you know, a spiritual connection through that service in a spiritual realm, but to some degree it's there in every relationship. So we were getting to this point of the verse we chanted aloud, which is on page 234 of the Bhagavad Gita. And it says that having obtained real knowledge from a self-realized soul, and we went back to the previous verse to talk about how we approach a self-realized soul, you will never fall again into such illusion. For by this knowledge you will see that all living beings are but part of the Supreme, or in other words, that they are mine. Purport. The result of receiving knowledge from a self-realized soul, or one who knows things as they are, is learning that all living beings are parts and parcels of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Lord Sri Krishna. The sense of an existence separate from Krishna is called maya. Ma, not, ya, this. Some think that we have nothing to do with Krishna, that Krishna is only a great historical personality, and that the Absolute is the impersonal Brahman. Factually, as it is stated in the Bhagavad Gita, this impersonal Brahman is the personal effulgence of Krishna. Krishna is the Supreme Personality of God. It is the cause of everything. In the Brahma Samhita, it is clearly stated that Krishna is the Supreme Personality of Godhead, the cause of all causes. Even the millions of incarnations are only his different expansions. There's if he gets too distracted, we have a middle room there that you can go to just temporarily if it becomes a case, just for your comfort, just in case. Even the millions of incarnations are only his different expansions. Similarly, the living entities are also expansions of Krishna. The Mayavadi philosophers wrongly think that Krishna loses his own separate existence in his many expansions. This thought is material in nature. We have experience in the material world that a thing, when fragmentally distributed, loses its own original identity. But the Mayavadi philosophers fail to understand that absolute means that 1 plus 1 is equal to 1, and that 1 minus 1 is also equal to 1. This is the case in the absolute world. For want of sufficient knowledge in the absolute science, we are now covered with illusion, and therefore we think that we are separate from Krishna. Although we are separated parts of Krishna, we are nevertheless not different from him. The bodily difference of the living entities is Maya, or not actual fact. We are all meant to satisfy Krishna. By Maya alone, Arjuna thought that the temporary bodily relationship with his kinsman was more important than his eternal spiritual relationship with Krishna. The whole teaching of the Gita is targeted towards this end, that a living being, as Krishna's eternal servitor, cannot be separated from Krishna, and his sense of being an identity apart from Krishna is called?
Maya.
Called?
Maya.
And what does Maya mean? The living entities, as separate parts and parcels of the Supreme, have a purpose to fulfill. Having forgotten that purpose since time immemorial, they are situated in different bodies as men, animals, demigods, etc. Such bodily differences arise from forgetfulness of the transcendental service of the Lord. But when one is engaged in transcendental service through Krishna consciousness, one becomes at once liberated from this illusion. One can acquire such pure knowledge only from the bona fide spiritual master, and thereby avoid the delusion that the living entity is equal to Krishna. Perfect knowledge is that the Supreme Soul, Krishna, is the supreme shelter for all living entities. In giving up such shelter, the living entities are deluded by the material energy, imagining themselves to have a separate identity. Thus, under different standards of material identity, they become forgetful of Krishna. When, however, such deluded living entities become situated in Krishna consciousness, it is to be understood that they are on the path of liberation. As confirmed in the Bhagavatam 2.10.6, Muktir Hitvayata Rupam Swarupena Vyavastitihi. Liberation means to be situated in one's constitutional position as an eternal servitor of Krishna, Krishna consciousness. So, what did you hear in that? What did you hear that struck you? Rakshit heard something that struck him. Could you use the microphone, please?
Unlike what the Mayavadi sannyasis have been preaching, that the living entity should become one with the absolute truth. What the purport is saying is that living entity maintains its identity in relationship to the Lord, that it is part and parcel of the Lord, but maintains its own identity. The Lord is there and the living entity is there, and there is an eternal relationship between the two. That has been somewhat forgotten, and so it has taken a material body. But it needs to come to the path of knowledge to realize that it needs to revive this relationship. And when it does, it won't lose its identity. Both are there. Both exist.
Thank you. So at near the end of the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says, Arjuna's illusion is gone. Because Krishna enlightened him, right, on the battlefield. Krishna became the guru, the spiritual master for Arjuna. And he taught him this knowledge. And at the end, where are they? They're on the battlefield, right? Before the battle starts. And it's not that after Arjuna's illusion was gone, that all of a sudden there was only one person there, that he merged into Krishna. So they were still there. Arjuna was there and Krishna was there, but now Arjuna's illusion was gone. And he saw how he was part and parcel of Krishna. And now his determination was to serve Krishna, to fight the battle on Krishna's behalf. So, nice point. What other points did you hear? What other things stuck in your mind from hearing this purport? Satyade Prabhu. Well,
Prabhupada points out there, and if we think about it, he said that this understanding that one is part and parcel of Krishna, that understanding can only really come from a bona fide spiritual master. And we see that, I have to generalize here, but 99.9% of what we hear in spiritual circles is that the living entity is God. Especially if it's of the Eastern persuasion, the Buddhist or Hindu. 99.9% of what people are saying is that we are God and that there's no distinction and that the goal of life is to realize this. And without getting this knowledge, the correct knowledge that the living entity is part and parcel, unless one receives this from a bona fide spiritual master, it's very difficult to understand. And you won't hear it from any other source. So it's a rare thing to receive. But once one does receive it, it's very clear, and then one can see the truth, where others are still in a bewildered state. And in a sense, our purpose here in the material world is to realize that we're part and parcel of God, that we're His servant. We are one. The Prabhupada points out here that the living entity is not different than Krishna. We are one with Krishna, but at the same time, we're not the source. You know, we're not the maintainer. We are being maintained. And it's when we come to this material world that we realize that, because we're helpless. You know, we didn't choose our birth, and we have no control over when we're going to die. And we're powerless from the beginning until the end. And the material world is an opportunity to realize that. And once we do, then there's the possibility of having a relationship with the Supreme. And so if we spend our time here trying to realize that we're one, then we haven't gone anywhere. We've missed our purpose. Because we are one, that's undeniable. But in oneness, there's no relationship. But when we come here, we realize, no, we're being maintained. We're one, but we're different. We're here to serve. And that realization can only happen when we're here in this material world. And we can only understand that when we connect with a bona fide spiritual master. Otherwise, we haven't actually made any progress, even if we become one again.
Powerful point. Thank you very much, Satya Prabhu. Dainiti has a point.
Well, actually,
what Satyadev said was, I was just reading that, but actually I have a question. I'll read the sentence before the sentence. I want to ask a question on it. Such bodily differences arise from forgetfulness of the transcendental service of the Lord. But when one is engaged in transcendental service through Krishna consciousness, one becomes at once liberated from this illusion. So that's my question is, how is it that when one is engaged in transcendental service through Krishna consciousness, one becomes at once liberated from illusion?
Iha yasya harer dasye karmana manasa gira. Rupa Goswami gives this verse. You can find it in your shloka book. But those who are engaging their body, mind, and words in the service of the Lord are considered to be on the liberated platform. And this is the eternal activity of the soul, to be engaged in devotional service. So in the beginning, when we first take it up, we're in the position of a servitor in practice. And we are considered to be in training. So although we may not have full realization in the beginning stage, still our activities are considered to be liberated because we're engaging in activities that are eternal, that are liberated activities in connection with Krishna. And the realization will follow. It's a matter of a coconut is a coconut. And at some stages, the inside of the coconut is connected, and then other time when it dries out, then the inside becomes disconnected. It's still a coconut, but at different stages of realization, one will, you know, understand more and more about spiritual life. Yes.
I really see that how it can be at once liberated is the knowledge, and how here it's saying that the knowledge is that we are part and parcel with Krishna, that when we have that bit of knowledge, it just starts there, so it's instantaneous. You remember when I was a child, mm-hmm. I saw a magic trick, like a card trick, mm-hmm. and you know, at first when you see it, you have no idea how it works, but the instant you have a little insight into how it works, it's almost like it all starts to unravel, that you start to see what it really means.
That's a really good example.
So, like, the whole part of the illusion is that you don't have knowledge in how it works. And so once you have that little bit of knowledge, it goes a long way into you understanding.
This is a very, very powerful analogy. Thank you for bringing that up. Really, really great. It reminded me of of the analogy in relation to this knowledge that Chaitanya Mahaprabhu gave. He taught this to Sanatan Goswami. He said that when we're without knowledge of ourself, and we don't know who we are, we become like a poor man who doesn't know who his family is. And in the particular case that he described to Sanatan Goswami, he gave this scenario. He said an astrologer was walking around the village, and he came to the door of this one man who was suffering very much due to poverty. And then he did a little astrological reading, and he said, wait a minute, you're not poor. What are you doing in this hovel? Why are you living like this? You're not actually poor. You're very wealthy. And the poor man said, what do you mean? He said, see, your father was one of the richest people in the land, and you got separated from him. Recently he died, and he left you his whole fortune. And all you have to do is go dig it up. And then he told him there are four different directions where the treasure is buried. And in one direction, if you go for it, there will be wasps that will bite you. Another place, ghosts will attack you. And then he said, if you go in one particular place and dig for it, you'll get it right away. It's really easy. And so Chaitanya Mahaprabhu says in that instruction to Sanatan Goswami that just like if you're poor and someone tells you you won the lottery, is if we tell, you know, Usha Mataji, we say, guess what, you just won, you know, $180 million. Her countenance will change immediately. It's not like you have to sit around and think about it. You just go like, I did? Yeah, you did. Okay, it changes everything. It doesn't actually, but studies have shown people become more miserable. But the fact of the matter is that when you find out that you're a wealthy person, in theory, that all of a sudden your life changes, you become happy. So Chaitanya Mahaprabhu said it's like that. When you actually gain what he called sambandha gyan, or knowledge of your actual relationship with Krishna, when someone tells you, wait a minute, you're not going to die because you're eternal. I remember the first time I read the second chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, I couldn't stop reading it over and over again. I said, this changes everything. Wait a minute, I'm not actually going to die because I'm not my body. I'm a spirit soul. And Krishna's saying from every different angle how, you know, the soul, it can't be burned, it can't be dried up, it can't be cut. And I was thinking, wow, look at that. And these people like, you know, Socrates, and they talked about these things too. And it's like, yeah, this is true. And immediately, you know, my life changed, you know, from hearing that knowledge. So it's such a nice point. When you see exactly what our position is here, then it changes everything. Just like seeing a magic trick. And you see what's behind it. And then all of a sudden, the illusion of it is all gone. And you just say, I know what that guy's doing. There's a little rubber band back there. It keeps pulling the ball around the other side. And it's no fun anymore. So same thing. When you see how Maya's working, then it's no fun anymore. Like, there's a verse in the Srimad Bhagavatam that says, someone's experienced Krishna consciousness. Even if they try to go away from Krishna consciousness again and go out and try to enjoy the material world, they can't forget the taste they had in Krishna consciousness. You find this, devotees, you know, people will join, and like Narada Muni says, Tyakva Sudharmam Charanam Bhujam Harer Bhajana Pakvo Ta Patet Pato Didi, that sometimes people take up Krishna consciousness out of some kind of sentiment, and they really don't know a lot about it, and they're called apakva, or they're like, they're immature, or not ripe yet. So they take it up very enthusiastically for a little while, and then they get distracted, and they go away, and they try to forget all about it. And, you know, over the years, we've met lots of people who have tried to, who've taken Krishna consciousness, tried to give it up, but it's not so easy. Because once you actually have an inkling for spiritual life and see the truth, you know, to try to go out and enjoy again and cover over your knowledge that actually you're not your body, it becomes very difficult. Of course, Krishna will help you if you're really sincere about it for a while. But devotees come back because they remember that taste over and over again, and that knowledge, once it's revealed, it's very difficult to give up. Thank you for that. It was great. Luann. Okay, get the $100 bill ready. Okay.
In the past few weeks, I was struggling with the idea
like this. Remember, I come from different background. I come from Buddhism, and my husband is American, so I'm a little exposed to Christianity too. And I have to say, neither of the two religions really answer all my questions. And I have difficulty to believe in any religion if that religion does not answer all the questions that I ask. Okay.
Understood.
Okay. Anyway, in the past weeks, I struggled with the idea that, let's say, Bill Gates, he doesn't know what Krishna is. Maybe he doesn't. He doesn't sing, chant Krishna. He doesn't say any mantra. Yet, he does give. He's able to, but he doesn't. Some people have money, but don't give. Or not system give anything. Bill Gates did give and help tons of people, thousands and thousands of people. So, but he didn't know Krishna, he didn't chant Krishna. How do you weight that? How do you weight a man who doesn't chant or doesn't know Krishna, but yet he helps the others, other living entities? So today, I learned one thing, which I'm very happy. Is,
yay!
I read these weeks, yeah. But somehow it didn't come to my mind. And somehow here something enlightened that those human beings, living entities, apostles of Krishna, apostles of Krishna.
Yes.
So helping those living entities, or serving those people, in a way, indirectly serving Krishna. Am I correct?
Yeah.
I read about it, but I never learned it until today, tonight.
Yes.
But now I still have the question, how do you weigh
okay.
between a person who chants
yeah.
the time
okay.
and who gives millions of dollars?
Like, let's go back to the analogy I gave
and
before.
What the society would be if you keep on chanting, and society would be...
Okay, that's another part. Let's go to the first part first. Because we want to talk about the quality of service to living entities. If you want to serve somebody, you want to see what's the best kind of service that you can do for them. And I gave this example earlier. If you find a lost child, you know, you can give them $5, say, you know, see you later, and drive home and don't tell anybody. Or you can put him in your car and take him back to his parents. Which is better quality?
Well, the Chinese say, you know, teach him how to fish rather than
exactly.
give him a fish to eat.
Exactly. So... what's better, you know, if you actually give someone, because we're all going to die, you know, if you feed somebody, if you give them surgery, if you fix their cataracts, things like that, they're still going to die. I mean, there's no question. If you see somebody suffering, you know, your heart goes out to them. You want to help them. What's the best way you can help them? If you take care of their physical ailments, first of all, it's not even guaranteed that we take care of their physical ailments. It's going to even help them. I mean, a lot of medical procedures and everything we do, it makes things worse. You know, like all kinds of medicines and things that, you know, we administer, they have adverse effects on people. And, you know, sometimes we intend to help somebody in a certain way and it doesn't actually help them. It kind of hurts them. There was a story in the paper in India, Prabhupada told about this, how there was two children at home and one of them had cholera. And it had this really high fever. And the doctor had said that this child cannot eat anything, otherwise he'll die, especially anything with oil or anything in it. And so the parents had to go to some emergency down the street, and they put the elder child in charge and said, listen, you take care of him. We'll be back in 10 minutes or so. And they were gone a little bit longer, like half an hour. And meanwhile, the younger child was saying, I'm so hungry, you know, couldn't you just give me, like, a little piece of cake or something, you know? And the older boy was thinking, oh, God, he wants something to eat, you know? All right, here, he gave him some cake. And when the parents came back, the child, the younger child had almost died, right? So now the question is, the older one was trying to do charity work. It's like, I'm going to help him out. He's hungry, he wants to eat. I'm going to feed him. So he gives him the cake and he almost kills him. So the fact of the matter is, we have to have full knowledge to help people. Because I can help somebody by feeding them, for instance, meat. I was going to feed the hungry. Well, what are you feeding them? I'm feeding them, dead animals. Now, there's some karma for that. So how much am I actually helping them? So to help people perfectly, we have to have perfect knowledge. And the best way to help people is to bring them to enlightenment, so they can help themselves. As you pointed out, you can teach, give somebody a, throw them a fish, or you can teach them how to fish for themselves, right? So that's the idea and the quality. If you want to know the quality of how to help somebody the most, the part and parcel of Krishna, how to help them the most, Krishna talks about it in the Bhagavad Gita. At the very end, we can look at this verse in the 18th chapter, and it's text number 64, is it? Nachatasman Manusheshu. It's text number 67 and 68. He says on page 752, this confidential knowledge, no wait, text 68 on page 753. For one who explains the supreme secret to the devotees, pure devotional service is guaranteed, and at the end he will come back to me. There's no servant in this world more dear to me than he, nor will there ever be one more dear. So one who enlightens somebody about their actual position and gives them this clear knowledge about who they actually are so that they can actually help themselves, that is considered by Krishna to be the best kind of service. However, if we're rendering service in some way, this is a more elevated life than just living for oneself. If you just live for yourself and you keep everything, this is not a very advanced kind of life. It's more like animal life. Most animals, maybe a few exceptions, but most animals, they take care of themselves or their immediate family, and that's it. They don't think about the general welfare of everybody else. Human beings can extend outward and try to do benefit to others. So the highest benefit, ultimately, is not just to feed people, because they're going to eat and be hungry the next day. And it's not just to, give them medicine, because they're going to take the medicine, get better, and they're going to get sick another time. And it's not like we're going to wipe out disease either, because the whole material world is based on these principles of birth, death, old age, and disease. It's not like, even if I have more money than Bill Gates, I'm going to wipe out disease completely. I'm not going to stop it. Disease is a concomitant part of living in this material body. It's a breeding ground for diseases, and anything can happen. So even if I spend trillions of dollars to help the poor, it doesn't mean that they're going to necessarily be in a better position because of the medicine or the food I gave them. But if I give them information by which they can elevate themselves to the perfection of knowledge, that's the best kind of charity, according to Krishna in the Bhagavad Gita. So that's the idea. And in the interim stage, those people who are spiritually minded, they also, it's not that they let people go hungry either, that they just say, oh, well, that doesn't matter. Prabhupada used to, insist that nobody within a 20-mile radius of the temple should go hungry. This is spiritual culture. In the Vedic culture, a person who has a house and has their own food, they're supposed to go outside on the porch before they eat for themselves. And they're supposed to call out in the four directions as loud as they can, three times, if anybody's hungry, please come and eat. And if a skunk comes up, you're supposed to feed the skunk. And if, 20 people come down the street, you're supposed to feed them too. And you should see them as, like an incarnation of God, because they came unannounced to your house. You should take care of them. That's spiritual culture. Any country that's cultured, you'll feel that, right? Where they have some feeling that, It's not just my house. Like if you live in the suburbs nowadays, you know, people kind of go in, shut the door, and then they don't care about anybody else because they have their TV in there and stuff. But, you know, in real culture, everyone's out trying to help each other. And this is an extension of spiritual knowledge. When people are spiritually enlightened, they also naturally do more to help others around them. They're more compassionate. So the highest quality of charity is to give people spiritual knowledge. And concomitant with that, there will be compassion for their temporary situation also, whether they're sick or hungry. And we also, you know, don't want people to go hungry. And we'd like to team up with Bill Gates if you have any connections. Yes?
I just wanted to answer my own question, although I think it was sort of answered. And that is on the... is this one working now?
Hare Krishna.
I'm 10,000 over here. anyway, and that is that how is one immediately liberated when they're in the right constitutional position? And then, you know, as Saitya was saying, is that, you know, 99% of the people actually think that they are God themselves. So immediately when you act, that's the answer to, you know, that was the sentence, is acting as a servant. So as soon as you act as a servant, you're immediately liberated from the false conception that you are equal or the master.
Bravo. So, very nice. I think a lot of good stuff came out tonight, and not the least of which I would say on top of my list is what Jonathan said about... That was just right down the pipe. He gave an analogy about how if you see a magic trick and then at first it looks mystical and you can't understand how they're doing it, but once you learn actually how they perform the trick, it ruins the illusion. So same thing, once we understand our relationship with Krishna and we see how Krishna's moving everything in this material world, Maya Jakshena Prakriti, then, you know, the whole glitter of Maya actually becomes exposed. It's through knowledge. From that knowledge, instantly one actually becomes liberated. And that's what Krishna's saying in this verse. So we should embrace it and stay close to the fire, because also Krishna's illusory potency, it's not that you see it once and then you're fixed up for life. Because if we turn away from Krishna, if we walk away from the fire, then easily we become cold again. We have to stay close. And that means always staying in the fire of Krishna consciousness, always keeping in the light of Krishna consciousness. And that's the science of Krishna consciousness, is how to organize your life so that you're always in the light and not in the darkness. As soon as we turn away again, we can forget also. Because Krishna's Maya, he says, Daivahi eshu gunamayi mama maya duratyaya mameva ye prapadyante mayametam tarantite. He said, my illusory energy is very difficult, some translations say impossible to overcome. But if you surrender to me, you can easily cross beyond it. And so, you know, Krishna's the source of all creation. He's the source of his illusory potency. And we can't overcome it just by our own power. We have to surrender unto him and please help me. And the best way to do that is to pray. And the best prayer is Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Ram, Hare Ram, Ram Ram, Hare Hare. Steve Jobs chants a little bit. He used to come to the temple in Berkeley to eat when he was a student. He said that in his graduation speech a couple of years ago. He told all the students about how when he was a starving student, he used to walk to the Hare Krishna temple to get food.
He used to walk 7 miles.
7 miles he used to walk to get a meal at the Krishna Consciousness Temple. And
which one?
I think it was the Berkeley Temple. Came to the Berkeley Temple. So today is the Divine Appearance Day of Advaita Acharya Prabhu. And he is in the theology of the Chaitanya Charitamrita, he is the incarnation of Mahavishnu and Sadashiva combined, actually. he is responsible for bringing Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu to this world. And the way that he brought him is instructive, and that is that he felt so much compassion for all the souls in the world who are suffering due to lack of Krishna consciousness, that he felt that Kali Yuga's influence was so strong that only Krishna himself could come and deliver the living entities. There was so much confusion going on with so many different philosophies and everything. So he said the only person who can solve this problem is Krishna himself. So what did he do? He was worshipping Shalagram Shila. And every day he would offer Ganga water and Tulsi leaves to Shalagram, because he found a verse in the Shastra that says that when one offers Ganga water and Tulsi leaves to Krishna, that he becomes so indebted to such a person that he'll give his very self. So he was worshipping Shalagram Shila every day, and loud cries, crying out for Krishna, please come, please appear. And Krishna heard his cries. He heard his plea and his prayers. And so he came as Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu to deliver everyone by spreading the Sankirtan movement. So Advaita Charya Prabhu, we should take shelter of him, because he's the one who makes Krishna appear in this world, that he induces him to come into this world. So this day of Advaita Charya's appearance day, we should pray to have shelter at his feet, and that he can also help Krishna to appear in our lives. And also, coming up next Monday is the appearance day of Nityananda Prabhu, who is the Adi Guru. He's the original Guru. And he represents all spiritual strength. So by rendering service to Advaita Acharya today, then Krishna will appear in our lives, and then he'll come and instruct us as Nityananda Prabhu and give us spiritual strength so that we can go back home, back to Godhead. And that's coming up next Monday. This whole week is dedicated to the service of Advaita Acharya and Nityananda Prabhu. And then, of course, after that, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu makes his appearance coming up in March for Gaur Purnima. So this weekend, we're having our monthly Sankirtan festival for Lord Nityananda Prabhu. And on Friday night, we're having a public Harinam chanting program. And of all places, Palo Alto, at a university in Emerson Street. That place is going to become a holy tirtha. I think it already is. And but it's nice to go to the same place over and over. I remember in Berkeley, California, the devotees always used to chant on Sproul Plaza. And for years, you know, you drive by and see them out there chanting. It left a real impression. So that will start on Friday night at what time? 6:59 p.m. is when it will start. And we'll have our book table, and we'll have a prasadam to distribute. Jagarini is making cookies. And we'll have tons of books to distribute, as usual. We have made a goal to distribute at least 1,200 books this weekend, and that everyone will also spend a little bit of time, besides their normal Sankirtan activities, to go door-to-door to give people prasadam and to give them books and to invite them to come to the temple or, you know, come to your house to learn about Krishna consciousness. So everyone will do that for a little bit of time too, right? Yeah. So that's coming up. Friday night is the Harinam Sankirtan. Everyone's welcome. Bring the whole family. It's the most fun that you can have in the universe on a Friday night. Everyone's welcome. Bring all your friends. And then Saturday morning we'll be meeting here at 7:30. And we'll chant the Brahma Samhita for special mercy and spiritual strength. And then we'll have a few other shlokas, and then we'll organize from here. There'll be parties going out to many different places all over Silicon Valley. And these spots are specially designed so that we're very much welcome there. They're legal spots where anybody can go. They're welcoming us to be there. And we'll have a book table. We'll have plenty of prasadam to give out and lots of books. and goodwill to give to people. And what's the first goal of our meeting people when we go out into public?
Good impression.
What is it?
To make a good impression.
To make a good impression. Yeah, so the first goal is not to distribute a book or to give them mercy, anything like that. Just consider this one thing, to leave them with a good impression. To be a kind friend to living beings. And this is a kind of yoga, because when we go out into public, of course, the first thing that my mind will think is like, oh, what am I doing? I'm going out of my comfort zone. You're leaving your comfort zone, and you know what zone you're going into? Your stretch zone. But then beyond the stretch zone is the panic zone. So we don't want anybody to go into the panic zone. We just want all of us to be in the stretch zone. So when you go in Sankirtan, it's a little bit of yoga because you have to go out and depend on Krishna. You're thinking, how will I do this? I don't know what to say. I don't know how to meet people or leave a good impression. So you have to go out and depend on Krishna. You go out with a party of people who have already been out many, many times and have a routine, and you can go out and watch how they give out prasadam and books and interact with people. And you can just render a little service. You know, just be there to encourage them if you want. And just watch. And go out and smile at people, wave to people, make a good impression. And when you feel like it, and when the spirit moves you, and you see somebody who wants to have some prasadam or something, you can jump in too. What do you think, Devji? Yeah, he came out so many times now to Santa Cruz. How many times have you been out there now? Four or five times, and I saw him out there the last couple times meeting so many nice people, just explaining in his own words what the Bhagavad Gita is, and you'd be surprised how many people are interested in Krishna consciousness. I was, right before when I was going to Honolulu a few weeks ago, I just before I left the house, I grabbed a, Super Soul told me to grab a Farsi book, a Farsi Perfection of Yoga, and I was about to leave the door, and I thought, better take a Farsi book. And the rational part of my mind said, why? You're going to Honolulu. What are you going to need a book in Persian for? And so, but I went back, and I grabbed it, and I jumped in the taxi cab and immediately noticed that the guy had beads. And I said, how many languages do you speak? And he goes, three. And I said, what are they? And he goes, English, Persian. I said, Persian. 10 seconds later. And I said, look at this. And I handed him the Farsi book. And all the way to the airport, he was looking at it. I was a little nervous because he was driving on the 101. And he's like looking at it back. And he sees the picture of Prabhupada on the back there. And he goes, oh, yes, this is a very good man. And I felt like, yes, Krishna wanted me to deliver this book to this person. He told me, you know, grab the book, put it. And so if we just make the arrangement to go out, take the prasadam, go out to your spot, we don't know what will happen. So this is yoga. We're connecting with Krishna because he says, go out. And we go out where? What do I do? And then you go out there and then you find out. You know, Krishna's got a plan for everybody. You know, and sometimes the plan is to, you know, help us to see how, you know, we're connected with everybody and how Krishna's making all the arrangement. It's the best kind of sadhana. We do this because it's the best kind of practice in spiritual life, to actually go out to show kindness to other living beings. That's our mission statement here. Mother Usha.
I want to share something that happened in my...
Give her the microphone.
I want to share something that happened in my company. Last, 2 months ago, I distributed some books to everyone in the company. So whether they want it or not, I just gave them. So one of the colleagues, he has that book in his Kindle. And 2 days ago, he came to me, and then he just said, I have this book for so long in my cubicle, I never opened it. Can you give me some brief introduction of that? Mm. And I was very happy about that, because initially when I gave him, he was a little bit reluctant. I told him, anyway, take it and keep it in your cubicle. Mm. And that made, like, wonder. Like, he came to me, and then he asked me, give me some introduction, I want to read this book. So I was very happy when he said that.
This is the time bomb effect. In fact, the devotees years ago, back in the early 70s, they made a movie. I actually have this in my house. It's a slideshow because they didn't have movies back then, about the books being like a time bomb. And people get them and they take them. Sometimes they put them in their house for a couple days or 2 years or 20 years. And we had a case when it was with Bhakta Ben. His mother bought a book in Los Angeles, and then she came back to Pittsburgh or wherever he lives. No, Baltimore. Put it on the shelf and didn't take it down for 30 years. It was up there. In the meantime, she had a child. He grew up. He was in his teens, and he started inquiring about spiritual life. And he said, I know, I have a spiritual book. I bought it 30 years ago in a parking lot. She took it down, handed it to him, and he became a devotee. And so these books are like time bombs. There was a case in the Denver airport when we used to distribute books in the airport. And when we go through security, we'd have to put the books on the conveyor belt, and they'd go through. And so there was one lady, a security guard there, and for some reason she had something against us. She didn't like us for some reason. So she tried to slow us down. Every time we'd go through security, she tried to slow us way down. She said, we got to check this box. She knew what was in the box. We got to check this. So she'd take the box. Could everyone move up by 1 foot? 1 foot, 2 inches? So she'd take the box and she'd take every book out one at a time. And she'd flip through it really slowly, like she was looking at every page. So with 20 books in the box, you know, it would take her 15, 20 minutes, and you'd have to stand there and wait. And meanwhile, you'd miss the whole rush of people coming by and all that kind of stuff. So all the devotees dreaded going through the security that when she was there. And then after about 6 months of doing that, one day we came back to the temple, in the Denver temple, at the Sunday feast, after Sankirtan. And I was standing at the back of the room with another devotee, and he nudged me, and he said, who is that up at the front? I said, who, where? He said, right over there. And so I looked and I said, no, it couldn't be. I said, I think it is. We went up and we found out it was that lady, the security guard. And after so much time of, you know, going through the books, even she didn't know what was in it, she became affected by it. Came to the temple and she came regularly. She'd come every Sunday, and she really liked it. She became a friend of the devotees after that. So we don't know what's going to happen. You know, one thing is that karma is not eternal. The karma that we have in this world, it's the one thing that can change. And what can change it is the spiritual knowledge, coming in contact with Krishna. So to go out and distribute literature is a very exalted kind of service that we can do. It's one that was very dear to Srila Prabhupada. And it's a very happy thing, too, as you can hear. It's very jolly. So anyway, that's coming this weekend. And I could just say that this weekend I have a feeling, now we're starting to warm up, it's going to be a really big weekend. Not just the temperatures warming up, but also we're all getting warmed up, back up to speed again here after a cold winter, and now the sun's starting to come back. And we'll distribute like anything this weekend. 1,200 is just a preliminary number that I actually put by mistake. I meant to put 15, and I accidentally put 12 for some reason. So Praveena said, don't worry, we'll keep that in mind, and we'll beat the 15, too. I think she said that. And so, but what my main point, my last point is that this is a warm-up for Gaur Purnima. So, you know, just like when you're getting ready for the Olympics and everything like that, you have time trials and you really have to put out. So this weekend we'll really, really put out just to see what we have in us for Gaur Purnima, because that's coming up as the next one, and that's going to be one of the big, big Sankirtan festivals of the whole year. Hari Bol! Thank you very much. Hare Krishna. So that's $100 towards the Lord Nityananda's Sankirtan festival. So we're off to a good start. Hare Krishna. Now, of course, Rakshit Prabhu would tell how there's three ways everyone can participate. You can go out on a Sankirtan party. You can donate Lakshmi, give money to sponsor the books. Or you can do some backup kind of services. Like Narahari Prabhu said, he's open on Thursday night to do some service. And we'll have to engage him somehow. There's something that he can do. He has some free time. But everyone, if you have some free time, you want to do some service in some way, let us know and we'll hook you up with something where you can help out for the overall effort of the Sankirtan party. Yes, Rakshit Prabhu.
And now donations can also be made on our website. We have a special link for Sankirtan donation. You can go on www.virtualtemple.org and you will find there a link, make donation to Sankirtan program. So in your own time, in your own way, you can do that. If you click on the link, it will take you to a page where there are different options, any amount you can choose. And all you do is another click and do the donation, and we'll be informed that you made the donation because it is designated for the books account, and the donation will be used to purchase books and will be used for book distribution. So your donation will be used for the purpose that it is given for.
Thank you very much. Good news.
Yes, it is www.virtualtemple.org.
Somebody, we can give her a card so she can go on. Yes. How's everyone feeling about the Sankirtan Festival this weekend?
Great.
That's good news. How's everyone else feeling?
Excited?
Okay. So everyone's into it. That's encouraging. Very nice. Okay, so you were going to say? We were smiling so nicely, just effulgence of the smile. All right, so it's such a happy time to have the Harinam Sankirtan on Friday. I've been looking forward to it all week. So everyone come. We'll give out mercy in the form of chanting and giving out prasadam, and then we'll have a great weekend. And Monday night, we're going to have, we'll all meet here for Lord Nityananda's appearance day. We'll have a feast. We'll have chanting. I said 6 o'clock, but I think that it's a holiday, isn't it?
Yes.
Does everyone have off?
Yes.
Well, do you want to start earlier then?
Yes.
Okay. What time do you want to start? A few companies have holidays. So some people have to call in sick, huh? Okay, so what time do you want to start? What's the consensus? Because 6, is that too late? Or do you want to start at 4 or 5? 5 o'clock? 4:45? 4 o'clock? Satyadev, what do you think?
Well, it depends. How many people are actually off? How many people have to work?
Monday.
So if you have to work, you can't get here till 6.
Can you get here by 6? Huh? Call in sick. We'll save that for Gaur Purnima,
yeah,
for the monthly Sankirtan Festival. Save all your sick days. Just kidding.
Then everybody has to work the next day.
Everybody has to work today. So what? Let's take a vote then. Who wants to come? Who wants to start the festival at 6 o'clock? Because the other one I'm going to say is going to be starting earlier. So who would like to start at 6 o'clock? 1, 2, 3, 4. 5. And who would like to start at 5 o'clock? He's voting twice. Who would like to start at 4 o'clock? 4 o'clock. Okay, so 5:30. We'll start at... Huh?
No one raised their hand for 6. 5 o'clock? 5
o'clock?
Yeah.
5 o'clock. Is that
you? You say 5 o'clock.
We'll get warmed up. Okay, 5 o'clock. If you're not here, what we're going to do, for all of you who are working and you can't get here till 6, what we're doing is we're getting the place warmed up for you. We're doing it as a service for you. So don't feel bad. We're just getting the vibration so high. We'll chant. So, okay, everyone, 5 o'clock. I'll put it out on the internet also so everyone knows, everyone else knows. Tell all your friends. Narhari Prabhu, you're going to make a point? Okay, so, monthly Sankirtan Festival, ki?
Jai!
Srila Prabhupada, ki?
Jai!
Bhagavad Gita, ki?
Jai!
Yes? You sure? What? And we're going to have door-to-door packs also. Okay, thousands of books here, and they'll be in little packets that you can hang on doorknobs also. Okay, they'll be available. Take them tonight?
Yeah, like we have a
Okay, if you're not going out Saturday, you can take them now. Go Primanande. Ki Jai.